World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. To the air now, and the extraordinary war of a Mitcham boy who desperately wanted to be a fighter pilot, and became instead a decorated bomber pilot and master bomber in the elite Pathfinder force. He flew 68 operations over Europe and was promoted to squadron leader at the age of just 19. It's the story of Lewis David Lester, better known as David Lester, DFC and Bar. I wonder why you don't use your first name, David.
Well, it seems to be a tradition in my family that to use the second names. My sister's Dorothy Joan, but she's known as Joan, and my mother's second name was used all the time, and others in the family have used it. So it's a tradition, really, to use a second name. Anyhow, David's a better name than Lewis anyway, I think.
Well, David, if I may call you that, then.
It's awkward when I'm dealing with the Department of Vets Affairs, when they, you know, if I'm in a waiting room waiting for a doctor, they call out for Lewis, and I don't move.
Well, a long time ago, 1923, 30th of June, born in Unley, South Australia.
Yes.
Paint the scene for me, the family, what was life like in those days?
Well, my father was in the AOF in World War One, and he was mad on discipline, and we were brought up more or less on a disciplined sort of manner, and you know the be home at 12 o'clock or else type of thing, you know, with standing at the front door with a strap. And I loved it, and we lived in Mitcham, and Mitcham was a great place, and I still like to call myself a Mitchamite from way back. My mother unfortunately took very ill with an incurable disease when she was just after the birth of my younger brother. That was very awkward, but my father looked after her for 35 odd years before she passed away. And then he sort of gave up after she died and just faded away, really.
He was a soldier? What unit did he serve in?
He was a soldier, and he was General Allenby's dispatch rider. So my brother's first name was Allenby, named after General Allenby. And he was in Palestine and in that area of the war. And he had malaria quite badly and suffered for that for years and years.
What about your schooling, David?
Yeah, I started school at the Mitcham Public School, now the Mitcham Primary School, until grade 7, and then went to Unley High School. I left Unley High in 1940 after having taken 2 years to get what was called the Intermediate Certificate. In those days, I wasn't a good scholar. I was more interested in playing sport than doing lectures and things like that.
Okay. Yeah. So, born in 1923, and you left school at what age?
I left school at the end of 1940. I would have been 17, yes. Yeah.
And you didn't work in civilian life for long, did you?
No. I got a job as an office boy with a manufacturer's agent in Adelaide, and was only there for when I was called up for the Air Force in August of 41. So I worked for them for about 8 months. I applied to join the Air Force when I was 17 and was placed on the reserve because the Air Force didn't take anybody until they were 18. So I had to be 18 before I got the call up from the Air Force.
Why the Air Force? Why did you want to serve in that particular?
Well, during 1940, I was very intrigued with the newsreels that came from England showing the dogfights of the fighter pilots over London in the against the with the RAF against the German fighters, and I used to watch them in awe. And sort of made up mind if ever I had the chance to join the forces, I would join the Air Force and hope to be a fighter pilot. That was my ambition, to fly a Spitfire or a Hurricane or something like that.
So your training, where was this and what did you fly?
My training, I started training at Parafield in Adelaide. I learned to fly on Tiger and Gypsy Moss. Then to Point Cook on Wirraways and Airspeed Oxfords, and then to England, and sort of career seemed to have changed from looking like being a fighter pilot towards being a bomber pilot. And although that was very disappointing, in the end it turned out to be quite a good career.
I'll say it was quite a good career. We'll have a look at that in just a moment. But you made the transition then from training on fighter aircraft.
Yes, well, the Wirraway, of course, was looked like we was going to finish on single engine fighters. But at Point Cook in Victoria, well, we started flying Wirraways. We all went off on leave after 2 months, and most of us that came from South Australia came back here on leave. And then when we got back to Point Cook, we found that the Wirraways had gone and had been replaced with Airspeed Oxfords, which were twin engine aircraft. Although that didn't worry us too much, because the thought of flying a single engine aircraft had gone, but they had twin engine fighters like the Bow Fighter and the Mosquito, so we could still be on fighters. But as I said, it didn't turn out that way.
You said there was initial disappointment, but what were those first experiences flying such a huge aircraft? Took me through that. How did you feel about being at the controls of something with a big crew to be responsible for?
It was an amazing feeling, really, to think that I was 19 and I could fly these Lancasters and Halifax bombers before I could drive a motor car or a motorbike, and which was quite crazy. But the training, both in the RAAF and the RAF, because we were seconded to the RAF in England, was amazing. I couldn't fault in any way, right throughout my Air Force career, the training I had from those people. And so really the transition from twin engine, four engine, became reasonably easy. Getting to know the landings properly was probably the hardest.
So this was, by now, you were 19 years of age. We've got to 1942, 43. We're up to now, aren't we? And you were seconded to the RAF.
Yes.
Bomber Command.
Yes.
And what was your first squadron?
The first squadron was 158 Squadron, an English squadron situated in East Yorkshire, a Halifax bomber, and I did a full tour of 31 operational flying with 158 Squadron.
So you were in Yorkshire, north of England, long way from Australia, yes. Weather very different, weather conditions very different.
Very much so, yes. Well, of course, I'd seen snow for the very first time, and cold. It was hard to get used to the cold, but we weathered it, and we had to.
Yes. Your first raid, David, your first operational engagement.
I thought you'd ask me that, and my very first raid, of course, was with as what was called a second dickie. While training at the four-engine training schools, the pilots were sent to an operational squadron to act as a second pilot just to get experience with one of the crews from the operational squadron. And the first two of my operational flights were with as a second dickie. Yeah. It wasn't until later when the whole crew were transferred to a squadron that we all flew together, crew of seven.
So where was that first raid?
The first raid, unfortunately I can't remember. It's something I should remember. I never thought I'd forget, but it was... I can't remember exactly where it was. I often criticise fellas that couldn't remember their first trip, but here I am now, can't remember what it was. And I don't know where my log is at the moment to look that up either, which is very disappointing.
But I guess you can remember your emotions, your sentiments, the mix of excitement and fear. Talk me through that.
Well, I can't remember exactly the feeling, but the thought of not coming back or being shot down never really worried me. My father was in the front line in the AIF, and I wanted to be in the front line in the Second World War, and being in a heavy bomber in Bomber Command gave me that opportunity.
158 Squadron, from there where did you move?
From 158 Squadron, after I'd finished, I did 31 trips with 158. Normally the finishing after 30 ops, but I had done 31 because we were a bit short of planes, and the RAF headquarters called for maximum effort on the Nuremberg raid on the 30th of March 1943, and so the crew weren't very happy about doing another one. But after we finished the 31st op, we all disbanded. I didn't want to stop flying. I didn't want to be transferred to anywhere where I'd be an instructor. And so I was sent to the RAF College at Cranwell to do what was called a junior commander's course, where they were all wing commanders and group captains who were being trained to take over as squadron commanders as was necessary. They learned how to be flying. Their flying days were over, but they were doing work to train them as OCs of squadrons.
But up until this time, you'd been a sergeant pilot, is that right?
What?
You'd been a sergeant pilot at first. You hadn't been commissioned initially?
No. I got my wings at Point Cook, mm-hmm. and had the sergeant's rank, and I arrived in England as a sergeant, and arrived on 158 Squadron as a sergeant. Yeah.
So you went to officer training, effectively, and came out then as a commissioned pilot.
Well, I wasn't officer training at all. I just fell into being an officer, just like that. We had an occasion one night when our squadron CO, who was not spoken, he had already done his tour of ops, finishing in 1940-41, and was posted to 158 Squadron as CO, but he had itchy feet to keep on flying. And although he was not allowed to fly, he decided he would. And, of course, as CO, he didn't have a crew, so he just took senior members of the squadron on a raid one night, and they were shot down.
Good Lord.
And one of the crew was the flight commander of Sea Flight, 158 Squadron, and the next day we arrived at the flight office, no flight commander, and other senior officers missing. No CO, no flight commander, other senior officers missing. It was the order of the day for all of the crews to meet at the flight office around about 11 a.m. There we would find out if we were needed for operational flying that night. Well, we arrived at the flight commander's office at 11 o'clock and no flight commander. The secret phone rang to tell us that we were required, no one there to answer it. And so I was probably, well, my myself and the crew in sea flight were probably the most experienced in terms of operational flying, and I was asked to do the work of the flight commander, whose rank was a squadron leader, and so I was a sergeant, acting squadron leader, really. And because air crews were very short at that time, they couldn't readily find a replacement flight commander, so I just was asked to keep on doing the job. And with it came the rise in rank to squadron leader. So I went from sergeant pilot to squadron leader in about, well, 6 weeks, I suppose.
At the age of 19?
At the age of 19, yes. I became, the squadron leader rank became substantive in September 1942, just after September, so I had turned 20.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you were born in 23, so it must have been...
They're 40...
It's probably 43.
43.
That's all right.
43, yes.
Now, so you've done your 30 trips. It's an interesting terminology here, because you talk about operational service and raids and trips. But the terminology used a lot these days is missions, and I don't know whether old flyers like you like that term or not.
Well, I've never worried about it. I've never used the word. And, yes, missions really became, it was an American term for doing, we called them ops.
Ops.
Well, I called them ops. Yep. Operational flying was the dumb, in the logbook would be number one, operational flying. We call them ops.
Well, let's call
them trips, but
let's call them ops.
Okay. Yeah, we call them ops. Yes, and quite often, not so much these days, but quite often when Air Force Bomber Command blokes met, you know, how many trips have you done, or how many ops have you done?
The convention was that after 30, you were withdrawn from the front line and you did something else.
Yes, that's right, yes. The members of the crew, the seven, were just sent anywhere. Most of them were sent as instructors to some training establishment, or they, because of their experience, they would have been sent to another squadron to act as a gunnery leader or a navigation leader, non-flying really.
But in your case?
In my case, I was sent to the RAF College, and I didn't like that. That was a course of about, it wasn't very long, but at the completion of that, the junior commander's course included subjects such as Air Force law and air flight all subjects needed for station CO. For some reason, I did well in Air Force law. Not that I was very interested, but I was sent as a assistant to assist in Air Force to finding out courts of inquiry, finding out why training aircraft crashed. And I was an assistant with a couple of others, and we were, the idea was that as assistants we would find out as much information as possible, and then when time was up, lawyers would come in and look at all the evidence and decide what their verdict would be. It was evident to me that the lawyers at that time were not actually in the Air Force. They weren't permanent Air Force. They were lawyers that were seconded by the Air Force to assist, and they were given acting rank, mainly as high as group captain or air marshal, even air commodore rather, and they would look at all the evidence we had gathered, and they made a decision. It was a non-flying job, but I wanted to fly. Yes. And so I got itchy feet and went back to the headquarters of 4 Group, which was the Halifax Group, in which I had been flying, to see if they could find me a flying job. Well, they didn't have one at the time, but suggested that I could nominate or volunteer to fly with the Pathfinders. So I took that option and was sent to the Pathfinder Navigator Training Unit, where other single people like observers and navigators and gunners who also didn't want to stop flying came, and I had picked up a crew at the Navigation Training Unit, and we joined Pathfinders. Flying Lancasters.
Come to Lancasters and Pathfinders, a famous Bomber Command outfit, in just a moment. I wondered, though, whether you could reflect on away from the courts of inquiry, away from the training. How did you relax? What did you do for entertainment or going to events or socialising?
Well, the airfields were the airfield that we were stationed on for 158 Squadron was a wartime airfield, which meant that all the places, the sleeping quarters and the washing quarters and everything else were all over the place. But there was a recreation room, a big recreation room, and they had a sergeant's quarters, a sergeant's recreation room, and then I, with the squadron lead, I had moved to the officers. And they had all sorts of entertainment, and we'd play snooker or listen to the radio or play table tennis or do all sorts of things like that.
What about weekend leave passes to go to London and the theatre?
Yes, well, that happened and, quite often, and the theatre was good, and a lot of well-known, I can't remember the names of some of the well-known things that were on, but we went to the theatre quite a bit. Spent a lot of time in Australia House in London. Of course, they had recreation activities, and they had the Boomerang Club, it was called at Australia House, where we could meet other Air Force people and general enjoy the time.
Well, I suppose you could also experience bombing from the other end, as it were, because surely while you were on leave, especially down in London, there might have been raids, Luftwaffe, and you would have to take shelter.
Oh yes, it was quite often I needed to take shelter. I stayed in London, was normally at, where most Australians stayed, at hotel, the Regent Palace Hotel or the Strain Palace Hotel, they had their basements for really shelter from air raids and things. Yeah.
So we've come now to the Pathfinders, and for those who don't know, I wonder whether you could explain the principle of pathfinding, how it worked, what its purpose was, please.
Well, the Pathfinders, perhaps I should start with why the Pathfinders. During the bombing, bear in mind that there was no bomber command in peacetime, and therefore when it was decided to create bomber command, most of the destructors, for example, had been full-time RAF, but instructors, they had no knowledge of bombing techniques, and the aircraft, the Wellington and the Whitley, were more or less past their G-date, and the fellows that when it bombed Germany were very inefficient. They tried their hardest, but the results were very inefficient. And the German defences, on the other hand, were very efficient. And so bombing during, say, 1940, early 1941, early 1942, bombing had not increased, and it was thought that only about one bomb in every 1,000 was reaching its target area. And so a number of well-known or high officers, high-ranking officers, decided that they should form a bombing force, elite bombing force of bombing crews that had experience with bombing command, with bombing raids. The Navy and the Army decided they could do it better. There were some thoughts, I believe, I don't know if that's true, but some thoughts of disbanding Bomber Command completely. At first, the suggestion of having an elite bombing force was not met with very much success. None of the squadrons wanted their best crews taken away to form a force. Even the head of Bomber Command, Bomber Harris, wouldn't agree. But eventually they decided this elite force would be formed. One of the gentlemen that was mainly responsible for forming was an Australian, a chap called Don Bennett. And he was made responsible for forming this elite force and was made the air officer commanding the elite force with the rank of Air Vice Marshal. And the idea was that the aircraft, the Pathfinder, and it was called the Pathfinder Force, this elite force was called the Pathfinder Force. So Bomber Command was divided into two forces, main force and the Pathfinder Force. The Pathfinder Force would be out in front of all bombing raids, some 20 minutes or so, and they would find the target. Having found the target, they would drop illuminating flares. So the oncoming bombers in main force would not have to find their own. For example, if they were bombing a railway yard, railway yards in a German city, a flare would be over the railway yards, and the oncoming bombers would just bomb the flare. Being told the flare, being told where to drop it by a master bomber, a Pathfinder, who was actually in charge of the whole raid. If the flare was out of, for example, if they were bombing the, to use an example, if they were bombing the Adelaide railway station and the flares landed on Adelaide Oval, well, the bombers were, the oncoming bombers wouldn't be told the wrong, told it was wrong, and they were told what to do accordingly.
Let's get the terminology right here then. The Pathfinder Force, it was called, you said?
And
PFF.
Yes.
Okay. And you'd, according to the record here, you had joined this by late 42. You'd turned 19, and you were in a squadron with a different number now. You left 158. What squadron were you with now?
Yes, the Pathfinder Squadron number 35. Again, an RAF squadron.
Right.
Yes. Strangely enough, I never flew with another Australian.
No.
All the time I was in England.
But pause for a moment from your dissertation just to read how your service with 158 was recognised, because the London Gazette on the 14th of January 1944 recorded the award of the Distinguished Flying Cross to Acting Squadron Leader Lewis David Lester. And it said, "This officer has attacked some of the most heavily defended targets in Germany, including objectives in Berlin, Hamburg and Cologne. He's a fine leader whose courage, skill and resolution have contributed in large measure to the fine fighting qualities of the flight he commands. Squadron Leader Lester has completed a large number of sorties and has invariably pressed home his attacks with vigour."
Yeah.
DFC, London Gazette, 1944.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yes.
Did you go to Buckingham Palace? What happened?
No, yes. Yeah, that's another story, how I got to be at Buckingham Palace. Yeah, we received the DFC from the King on a special day, a special investiture with only eight of us, and we had a private talk with the King.
Can you recall what King George VI said to you? Can you recall what King George VI said to you on that occasion?
Yes, we were briefed before we went in and how to handle it, because King George VI had an impediment in his speech, and we were told really to keep the conversation going. He would ask us a question: where did we come from? And instead of just saying Adelaide, South Australia, he would like more information about that. And we would do the talking, because he was embarrassed, apparently, so we heard, about his speech. But he made conversation with all of us, and we spent at least three-quarters of an hour after the investiture just chatting away. I can see him even now in the Princess's music room. Yeah. And he's leaning on the mantelpiece, smoking a pipe, I think he was. And,
extraordinary experience.
Extraordinary experience, yes.
For a 19-year-old squadron. Well,
yes.
Well, you had just turned 20 by then.
Yeah. Yes, I had turned 20 by then, yes.
So, DFC, and then off for the Pathfinders, and more raids. More ops?
Yes, I did 37 ops with 35 squadron on Lancasters. So it was 31 on Halifaxes and 37 on Lancasters. Yeah. Now,
the transition to the Lancaster, how did it compare to the
Halifax? It was very easy comparison. Just to really... it was necessary to find out the different speeds and that sort of thing, but the landing was almost identical. And,
but flying in, lighting the way as well as leading the way, incredibly dangerous, surely.
Oh, well, yes. The Pathfinders led the way in as well, and so... every now and again for the following bombers, if they were a little bit off course, well, the Pathfinders would drop flares on the way so that it would keep them on track. Because a lot of the problems earlier with chaps' planes being shot down was that they were getting off course. And once one veered off course, well, he became an easy target for the... for the bombers, for the flak, the gunners, and the night fighters.
Yeah. So, which aircraft were dropping the flares first? Who was doing that?
Well, they all had different names, different stages of experience in the Pathfinder force, and. For example, to find the actual target, with the first Pathfinders arriving, they would drop an illuminating flare and allow the master bomber to see where he was, and he could see the railway yards or whatever before any flares were dropped.
And your particular job, what did you have to do?
Well, depends. We would start off just as they would call a supporter. So we arrived at the Pathfinder Squadron as a very experienced crew. All of us had done 30 trips, say, or nearly 30. I think the average was 30... 200 and something between us, But we, when we arrived at the Pathfinder Squadron, we were just the early crew, the new crew. We had to, we started off as what was called a supporter. And on the way, as we got more experience, we had different names. A blind marker who would drop flares in the air, a visual marker, a visual centerer, all sorts of things. A raid tended to get off track a bit, so if the master bomber found that the raid was getting off track and bombs were missing, he would redirect the flare. They would change flare and change colours in flares because the Germans started using flares as well, dropping them away.
Decoy.
Yeah,
I had heard those terms before and didn't know really what they meant.
Decoy.
If you forgive me if it's a terribly naive question. No. It might not be, but wasn't there a terrible danger of yourself being bombed by your own side from the bombers higher up?
Yeah, well, yes, that's right. Yes, well, generally, we were flying at a much lower altitude, so we had the problem of bombs coming down as well as flak going up, yes. And some Pathfinder planes were hit that way.
You were hit, weren't you?
Yes, we were hit, yes.
What happened?
When did you hear we were hit a couple of times?
I was doing some research and reading some of your previous discussions on this topic and how you had to take a badly shot up aircraft back to base on more than one occasion.
Yes, well, I'm not quite. We got hit.
You came back. It's one occasion you told someone we'd come back with three engines and a lot of holes in the aircraft.
Yes, well, it was dangerous. See, what happened? The ACAC games would fire in the air. Sometimes would have an aircraft in their sights and could fire directly at it. Sometimes they would just fire in the air and the shells would explode, and when they explode there'd be shrapnel all over the place. You get 1,000 guns firing, it's just a lot of shrapnel. So not many planes came back without a hole somewhere or other. And because if the shrapnel went into the engine, may have cut a petrol pipeline or something else. It was very difficult. So the shrapnel went into one of our engines and did just that, cut a petrol line. But we were hit, got that painting of the Lancaster there, we got hit in the tailplane.
Yes.
But we were trained for that, and with the assistance of a marvellous crew, we were able to get out of most dangers. We never had to bail out, fortunately. We had a parachutes on a couple of times, thinking we might, but that didn't happen, fortunately.
Yes, you mentioned your crew, and I would like to talk about that, because the selection of the crew and the rapport they established was clearly a critical factor. You picked your crew, is that right? As the pilot, you could select them?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. At the what was it called? The heavy conversion unit is where we actually learnt to fly four-engine aircraft. It's where we picked up a crew. Now, so at the end of the pilot training, we would be sent to the heavy conversion unit. Our navigator at the head of his training would be sent to the heavy conveyors unit. The wireless operator, the gunners, and so on. And so we would just pick someone that came through the gate or somebody through the main gate, yes. If I was in the mess looking for a navigator and I saw one come through the door, well, I would try and grab him before anybody else got him. And it was just like that. It was unbelievable how crews were selected. It didn't always work out exactly right, but that was how it was done. Unbelievable. Some crews used to stand at the, go out and stand at the main gate and wait for a gunner or a, navigator, you heard that, and a gunner to come in. And
so the crew you had for most of the time, were you able to keep them as a tightly knit unit?
Oh yes, you had to, yes, because I had two crews. I had the Halifax crew, and then when I went on to Pathfinders, I had another crew. But it was vitally necessary to get on well with each other and to know each other's
idiosyncrasies.
You had to. You relied entirely on, say, a gunner, if he saw an enemy fighter, to direct a pilot to it, and so on. The navigator had to be spot on, no ifs or buts, spot on, particularly on navigator, on Pathfinders. The navigator on Pathfinders became really the kingpin. The pilot was just a driver.
68 trips, 68 golfs,
yes. Yeah.
And you survived. It's astonishing.
Yes, well, yes, having good crews helps, of course, and knowing just what to do in certain circumstances, dodging searchlights. Well, most of the towns that we were bombing had heavy defences, guns, searchlights, night fighters. Probably a town called Essen was, I'm often asked what I thought was the worst town I bombed, and I think Essen, it was reported that Essen had 3,000 heavy AK-AK guns. We can imagine 3,000 AK-AK guns firing into the air, the bomber force. They had to hit somebody, and they did, of course, and that was. But the searchlights, once you got caught in a searchlight, it was just absolutely no hope. If you got hit by an AK-AK gun, an AK-AK shell, depend where it hit, of course, you could get out of it. If you got caught in searchlights, just no hope. And I often tell people, and even to this day, I could look up into the sky at night and I can see a plane caught in searchlight. Because once one plane got caught in a searchlight, it was other searchlight would immediately focus on that one plane as well. And so would the night fighters, and so would the gunners. The pilot couldn't see, blinded by the searchlight. The crew would come in to help. They couldn't see. They wouldn't know where they were, upside down. You could think of seven men in the plane struggling, knowing that that was it. So I always say searchlight's the worst.
We come to 1945, and unfortunately I don't have this citation, but after the end of this series of ops, there was a bar to your DFC,
yeah.
another award. Talk me through that experience, please.
Well, that was not for any one particular event. The CO more or less indicated that he was going to recommend the bar to the DFC, and what would I thought if he said this or that about one particular raid? But I didn't like that, and so we agreed that it would be getting through the 37 ops at much the same writing, strangely enough, as the first one. But I don't have that citation. It's somewhere. I think my son's got it in Melbourne. But it was for the whole 37 ops. The whole crew got a recommendation for something or other, whether the DFC or the navigator. Pathfinders already had the DFC and bar when I got him, and so he finished up with the DSO.
Right.
And
was there another investiture?
Yes. That was the same one. Yes, that was in. I think that was in early January 45. Yes. So the DFC to DFC DM bar. Were at the same time.
That was when the King
yes.
invested here with the award.
Yes, yes, that's right, yes.
So we've come to 1945, 68 ops, final year of the war, but still plenty of action in Europe. What were you doing at this stage? What happened to you?
We decided in either late December or early January that we would had enough, and the crew decided they'd had enough, and I decided. And at that time, the then managing director of Qantas Airways was in London with the aim of restarting the England-Australia air run on Lancastrian aircraft. The Lancasters were refitted to commercial planes, and they were calling for experienced Lancaster pilots to apply for that job. I put an application in and got it. When I got back to Australia, I had to be discharged from the Air Force before I could join Qantas. I was discharged as medically unfit, deaf in one ear, and the federal government at the time had a Department of Civil Aviation, and they would not allow anybody to fly that had any defect at all. You had a broken toenail. You couldn't, and so I was discharged medically unfit, and had to do a lot of tests on the ear, and still didn't. By the time time to join Qantas had passed as a employee, and the Air Force still mucking around my ear, and so I just missed out on flying with Qantas.
The war for you effectively was over, and you had this wonderful opportunity for to be an airline pilot, but it appeared it was denied you because of this ear complaint. Yeah. And the long protracted series of tests you had to go through.
That's right, yes. That took until August 45. And as a matter of fact, That was the 15th of August, 45. That was exactly 4 years from the day that I joined August 41. It was very, very hard to get a job in civilian life. You know, I'd started off, as I said before, as an office boy, with the idea of going through the ranks and perhaps being with a manufacturer's agent and being with him as a senior salesman. Someone else had taken my place as an office boy, and of course he was now the senior salesman. And that happened to all of us, that sort of thing. And we got back and really no jobs for us. I had a friend who knew a friend that got me a job in the soft goods industry, the dress materials and that sort of thing, who I had experience with as an office boy with. He got me a job with a Sydney company representing here in Adelaide, but that didn't last very long because unfortunately the boss of the company in Sydney died and the office closed. So I then got into the food game, and I worked with Cadbury's for 4 years.
Doing what? What was your job with them? What precisely was your job with them?
Oh, just as a salesman, commercial salesman, and for the last couple of years with Cadbury's, I was a country salesman. Used to do the whole of South Australia, selling chocolates and eating them, by the way, and still do.
Yeah. So you'd left this astonishingly dramatic, dangerous, precarious life in Europe. You'd come to South Australia, there'd been some problems with employment, a protracted departure from the forces for medical reasons. Eventually, you secure a job as a travelling salesman around country towns in South Australia selling chocolate. It's a huge contrast.
Right. South Australia and Broken Hill.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you settle down to it all right, or were there difficulties?
Oh, it was difficult, yeah. Couldn't really settle down. The bosses were all fellows that hadn't been at the war. They were younger, and not their fault they didn't get to the war. They just weren't old enough. But they got all the top jobs. And those of us that came back with no experience of anything, we had to take what we could get.
Yeah. But things worked out. What turned life around for you?
Reasonably. I left Cadbury's because I really didn't get on with the boss for that reason of him taking jobs that we normally would have had. And I got into the food industry as a salesman. I'm for 7 years with a snack food industry. And then 20 years in the dairy industry. That saw me out.
What industry was that exactly?
The dairy industry. I represented, I was the South Australian representative of the Australian Dairy Corporation, representing all dairy companies, not just one. I had 20 years to the day with them.
And you'd married by this time?
Yes, I married in 1946, been married 71 years, and I knew my wife Joan actually before the war. Our family was friendly with her family, and we sort of grew up, we knew each other when we were teenagers. And when I came back, she was still there, and we married in 1946.
And you're still very young, you're only 22. Were you haunted by the experiences, by the searchlights? Were they still there in your head?
Yes, and still are.
Still are?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was just telling my wife yesterday or the day before about you coming, and I'm having dreams lately of Air Force bombings. And I wake up, I can't remember much about what's happened, but I don't know whether I'm reliving some of the bombing raids or whether they're dreaming up new ones. That's a worry.
Nevertheless, you have been back to relive the experiences with others. You've been back to, for example, the Bomber Command Memorial in London, the dedication of that.
Yes.
That was 2015, I think.
2012. Yeah, 2012, yes.
Tell me about that day.
Well, it was the Department of Veteran Affairs called for nominations to go to England, London, to a dedication ceremony by the Queen for a Bomber Command Memorial in Green Park. I put in an application and was one of the group. There were 31 of us went all together on DVA, and five from here. I was in terms of ops, I had done the most, and seemed to be picked out to do a lot of things, including being taken there right down to the very front seats of the, there were about 10,000 there, and I was in the front seats. The Queen was there with the Duke of Edinburgh, the Prince of Wales, and the Duchess, his wife, and Prince Andrew all at this opening, and they were sitting in the front row and I was sitting in the front row. And the Queen actually unveiled the memorial and left straight away. She had been to Ireland and only arrived back the day before. So she didn't actually stay long. She and the Duke of Edinburgh left. But as she left the front row, she had to walk right past where I was sitting. About six of us in the front row, and so she stopped and had a chat to us. Yes, asked us where we're from, and I got a photograph in the front room. I'll show you. We're talking to the Queen, because I am very much a monarchist, and so it was good. So I've shaken the King's hand and I've shaken the Queen's hand. Not many have done that.
And you were also selected, were you not, to read the Ode of Remembrance?
Yes, that's right, yes. And they had a special service at the Australian War Memorial before we all left. And I was asked to read the Ode. So that was everything. It was good. And I had my 89th birthday there before we left. It was in June. 2012, and on the last week in June, and on the Friday night at the end of the visit, we had a big dinner in the David Military Club in London, and they gave me a special birthday cake with candles and
The memorial took a long time in coming, and I suppose one of the political sensitivities was that there had been a lot of criticism of the extent of the operations of Bomber Command. How do you answer people who are critical of that, saying that Bomber Harris just went at it too hard?
I answer it telling them to look at history, really. I'm a great supporter of what Bomber Harris did. And there's a lot of, as you say, and they're still throwing red paint over his memorial, over his statue in London, unfortunately. But I think it was good. I think Bomber Command was necessary. It is my opinion that Bomber Command shortened the war. I think all his decisions were right, including the one for Dresden. You've probably heard a lot about that. I have no excuse for Dresden. When the Germans bombed towns in cities in England, including London, and I was there for some of the bombings, they just bombed indiscriminately. We went to a city and bombed a rail yard or something specific, and to Dresden. And we did what they did. Now, Dresden, a lot of the cities in Germany had been battered, and their manufacturing, particularly of war materials, had been bombed. Now, in Dresden, so I believe, they set up any little place they could find, or a hall, a church hall, or an institute, or, and set them up making ammunitions. And so it was necessary to bomb all over. They had these little places all over Dresden, so I'm told. And so they had to be stopped.
As a boy and living at Glenelg, Ron George always liked mucking about in boats. There was work to be done too, though, and he qualified as a welder, working first in